My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest captained Team GB in the very first Invictus Games. After losing both legs in Afghanistan, he was determined to achieve in life and become more than his injury. He was awarded an MBE, became a Paralympian at the Rio Games, and is now researching for his PhD. Episode 23, Dave Henson, this is Declassified. So you passed out of Sandhurst in December 2008. You spent 7 months on a troop commander's course before joining 22 Engineer Regiment. Why did you join up?
Why did I join the army as a whole?
Yeah.
I don't really remember ever wanting to do anything else. So when I was at school, so we're talking about 14, 15, year 10, we had the careers fair come round. And the army, like they always do, had a particularly Gucci recruitment team. They took us off to go and play like laser clay pigeon shooting. And all the other recruiters that come around had like a piece of paper and a stand maybe. So I was like, that's it. I'm joining the army. It's obviously going to be amazing. So I sort of set my sights on that. But equally, I was in all the top sets at school. I was reasonably clever at that sort of stuff. So I kind of knew I was going to college and I knew I was going to do my A-levels. And actually, it felt like the officer route was probably the best route academically for me. You know, in reality, whether that was the case or not, is sort of a bit of a discussion point, really. But I went down the officer route and it was kind of what I always wanted to do. Always wanted to join the military from the age I could think about a career.
How did your degree work then? How did it work?
It was a bit of a weird way I did my degree. So I did a 4-year mechanical engineering degree up at the University of Hertfordshire. And year three of that 4-year course is a year in industry. Some of my mates went to work for Rolls-Royce or some satellite engineering firms or some Formula One race teams were quite common. But I applied for two placements. One was to Xerox, the photocopying company, and the other one was to the Army. And those were my two choices for my year three engineering degree. And thankfully, the Army took me in, otherwise perhaps life would have worked out a little bit differently. I'd have been stacking up toner cartridges as we speak. But no, I joined the Army as year three of my degree and sort of, yeah, just spent a year in the Army in uniform. No, not a soldier in bone in my body at that point, but yeah.
And then when did you finish your degree? Did you finish your degree in the Army?
No, so I did that third year. So sort of join the Army, do a year, leave the Army. You can transfer into the reserves if you want, but I just left the Army and finished my final year of my degree. So I finished that in June 2007 and actually went to work for the Navy as a contractor for 6 months after that on their mine hunting ships before starting back in Sandhurst in January 2008.
And then Sandhurst, finishing that, going to 22 Engineer Regiment down in Tidworth.
Yeah.
What was life like there?
It was awesome. It was busy. Yeah, it was busy. So this was, summer 2009. So things were still manically busy as far as the operational rotations were concerned. Two of our squadrons, not mine, in 22 Engineer Regiment, were going out to supplement 23 Engineer Regiment for the forthcoming tour. The next year, so we knew that two squadrons were about to go out. So they were in
to Afghan.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So they were sort of getting ready to go. I think the unit had come back from Iraq, maybe late 2007, early 2008. So it was a reasonably busy time. So I arrived in unit about 2 weeks before summer leave. So I had a 2-week handover takeover. Some summer leave, so it was another 2-week block, and then it was straight out to Canada for Medman, so an armoured exercise, an armoured battle group exercise, which was amazing. So sort of baptism by fire, really, straight out onto the Canadian prairies. Had not a clue what armoured engineering was, didn't have a vehicle commander's licence, anything like that. So yeah, it was really sort of chuck yourself in at the deep end. So yeah, it was busy, and then came back from that, and it was straight on to a junior NCO's cadre, was just providing BATSIM support. And then back from that, and it was straight up to Cumbria. I think it was called Operation Giraffe, which was just flood relief operations in Cumbria. Went to build a bridge in the northwest of England there, and that was it. The call for the tour came in, really.
And then Herrick came in.
Yeah.
You deployed October 2010.
Yeah.
At this point, are you experienced? Are you experienced enough to be taking blokes out?
God, no. No. I don't think you're ever experienced enough as a lieutenant anyway to take blokes out in a completely unsupervised sense of the word. You're definitely learning things still. And I was fortunate there are people around me to teach it. On paper, I was fully qualified for everything I needed to do as a junior officer to promote up to captain. And because of that condensed period of activity between arriving at 2-2 in the June and finishing that flood relief operation in the December, all of those boxes you need on your OJAR had all been ticked. So technically, I didn't really need to do all of those other kind of officer stuff, the regimental duty type stuff, in order to meet the promotion criteria. Everything had been done. So that's why in the February of 2010, my boss gave me a call and said, we've got this surge troop requirement. Would you like to go off and form a new troop from our regiment to deploy out as search to Afghanistan in 7-8 months' time at that point? So
And we've overviewed search before on this, but what would characteristically be a search troop?
So in our case, it was two search teams. So it was myself as an officer and a staff sergeant, Stu. We were both in charge of each one of the search teams, and then two corporals, and then two lance corporals in each team, plus four searchers. So it was an officer or a senior, a corporal, a lance corporal, and then four searchers.
And what have you got to do to get to that point? So from the Feb, when they said, oh, let's go with this, to the October when you actually deployed, what's in between that? So
so it was pre-deployment training and role-specific training. So you've got all of the normal pre-deployment training that any unit has to go and do. But for us, we also had to go off and get qualified in search. So for me, it was a case of going off and doing my search advisors course. Ended up doing that twice, mainly because I was crap, as it turned out, at searching. So I went on the first course, failed it, went back again and passed the second time, which is thankful. So, yeah, it was lots and lots of training to get to that point, and then linking up with our unit, because we were detached from 2-2 Engineer Regiment and attached to 3-3 EOD Engineer Regiment for the tour. It was then linking up with the regiment we were working with and pushing through all the normal pre-deployment training.
And that pre-deployment training, all that specific stuff with the search, and then are you getting trained by the lads that have just come out of Afghanistan? Is that how it works?
In the pre-deployment training, yeah.
Yeah, so you're getting the most up-to-date training can be without actually being there.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
So the search-specific course, the search advisors course, is a bit more generic. They're constantly getting fed updates from theatre anyway, but that's like your qualification course. And then all of the pre-deployment training was with blokes that had just come back off the previous tour.
Mm. And then, so let's fly out then. Let's fly out to Afghan. Yeah. Did you fly into Bastion?
So we flew into Kandahar and then got a Herc into Bastion.
Mm. What was it like then, first kind of? Again, we've gone over this on this podcast before, but from your point of view, young troop commander, no operational experience as such, in charge of X amount of blokes. What's it like the 2 weeks before when you're on leave and just milling around camp, getting stuff ready, actually getting out there on the ground? What's the feeling like?
It's a weird one. So because we've been so busy, so from the February all the way through until around about probably the second week in September, I think our pre-deployment training finished. So that's a long period of pre-deployment training, but there was other bits in there as well. So if you consider the battle group type situation or the company group situation in Afghanistan, the infantry call signs, the armoured call signs need to know how to work with search troops as well. So we were then feeding into their pre-deployment training as well. So it was perhaps a little bit longer than you would expect. But yeah, it was probably the second week in September where we actually finished all that stuff. Everything was done, everything was ticked off. And then it was sort of, had maybe a week's leave or something. And then it was it was literally that, a couple of weeks of just doing fears and getting ready to go. And that's probably when tempers were starting to fray, really. And it was weird because it was like the easiest part of our time getting ready to go. But because everything was done now, the lads had sort of made peace with the dangers. You know, going to look for bombs is not a risk-free pastime, you know. I wouldn't say it's a hobby activity. It's pretty dangerous. And so the lads have sort of got to grips with that and were just wanting to get out the door. So there we were in camp in Tidworth, just sort of playing football or volleyball or whatever it was. And people are just snapping, just saying, it's absolute bullshit. And why can't we just go? And you know, that's when you start to see tempers fraying a little bit. And the reality is this was the easiest time. Like, let's just be all right with it. Mm. Make peace with the fact that we have very little to do and get on with it. And but yeah, it was actually quite tough, those couple of weeks getting ready to go. For me personally, no clue what to expect when we got out there. Like the soldiers I was taking out, I had an idea of the risk, a massive idea of the risk. You know, already people from my search course the first time had gone out on Herrick 12, had been deployed on Herrick 12 and been blown up. I knew these guys, I knew the risks, and so I was probably pretty concerned with that. So maybe distant from my family, that kind of stuff. And but yeah, then it was out. It was out in Afghanistan. Sunday, you were there.
Yeah, that's just before we moved to being out. That's something that happens again and again, and it's that when you start distancing yourself away. And I think that's something to expect when people are going away to, especially like hostile environments and high pressure situations, is that distancing. You're kind of almost taking one part of your brain out and leaving it at home and getting ready for the next part. So let's go then. So where did you then go from? So did you stay in Bastion? Or did you?
I stayed in Bastion for about a week. That sucked. That first week sucked. So we turned up. I think most flights into Bastion get in darkness anyway, just for any kind of surface to air threat, I guess. I'm assuming it was normal anyway. We arrived in darkness and you get put into transit accommodation for that first night. So got into transit accommodation, and then the next day we sort of got put into our line. So even though we were out in different fobs and checkpoints and stuff through the remainder of our tour, you always have a bed space in Bastion. So if you need to come back in for courses or leave or whatever, you've always got a bed space to get back to. So we were then sort of taken to our lines the next day, and straight away it's like, this person's been killed. So this was a corporal who I'd taken over for. So I was his search team advisor during one of these training exercises for an infantry company group that I was just talking about. So I sort of covered for another Risa that was on a career course, slash didn't want to do the exercise. So I went and covered for that. And then, yeah, the first day that we arrived into our lines, we found out he'd been killed. So he'd been out on the ground as a search team commander, you know, doing exactly the same job as our lads, for a very good friend of mine, actually. And that was our first day in Bastion.
IED?
Yeah, IED, yeah, it's still in it and pink mist. It was a pretty rude awakening, I guess, to that. And it was then like, you know, we're new to role. So even though some of my soldiers had been to Afghanistan or on tours before, we were new to this search role. And suddenly the realities of this role were hitting on day one. And we hadn't even started our reception, staging, onward integration training before our RSOI package yet. That was something to get over. It was a massive wake-up call as to the genuine realities of the situation. You can read all the statistics you want in a newspaper, but when you're on the ground and suddenly that guy that you were having brews with a couple of weeks ago on Salisbury Plain is not here anymore, that's pretty tough. And actually it carried on for that week as well. So originally we were assigned to go to one particular area, one particular part of the operating. I can't remember where it was now. And then we had a search team advisor had lost his leg, and his search team commander had been temporarily turned out blinded by the blast. So like straight away within this first week, we'd had one killed, one guy, single leg missing, and another team commander blinded. We ended up taking over from then. And then one of my mates from Sandhurst, he was there as a search advisor, his one of his searches was then a double amputee from a bomb blast as well, like all within like week one. It was insane. It was before we left Bassam. Ridiculous. So it was a hard entry into Afghanistan, like mentally.
Yeah, and scary with it.
Yeah, that's the whole point. It's scary. I mean, you know, we're then in the situation where, you know, me as a non-experienced lieutenant has to then say, let's go and do this job, or doing this job is a good idea, and make sure the lads are doing everything they possibly can to keep their eyes on the ball and do their job when all these people have just been blown up.
Mm.
That was tough.
And that, so but we, you finally do your bits and pieces in Bastion, your little bits of training, you get out on the ground. Is there a handover takeover?
No, he'd been blown up.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, so that was it. In fact, our handover takeover took place in Birmingham. So he came to visit me after I'd been blown up, the same bloke. So we did our handover takeover 4 months down the line. But that was it. He'd been blown up. So we went to this, they call it the patrol baseline. It was in Nari Siraj, north in the upper Goresh Valley, I think.
How'd you get there? Helicopter?
We did a road move, a desert move. Yeah. So we were assigned to work with the Danish infantry. So we were working with a company of Danish infantry, armoured infantry, which is awesome. So there's a couple of Piranha armoured vehicles. But yeah, we did a road move with the Danes. So basically a whole load of like ISO container wagons through the desert to Nari Siraj. That was it. It probably took like 4 or 5 hours or something, because you just kept stopping all the time as you had to drive through these minefields. Were pretty miserable. But yeah, we were just in an ISO container that had been fitted with some bar armor and like some roller coaster seats in the back. That was it.
Yeah.
You're just shut in an ISO container and off you go.
You're locked in?
I don't think we're locked in.
No, but it's closed.
Yeah, it's closed. Yeah. And that was it. You can't see anything. And then you just, like, the door's open. You're in the middle of the desert. You have a piss, you have a smoke, and then you get back in and off you go. And then where did we turn up? Fob. I think it's Fob Price is probably the main base in that area. It's a while ago now, so my memory sort of fades a little bit, but yeah, I think we turned up in Fob Price. I think it was where the Danes were based. And then, like, it was weird, there's like a naffy there, there's a coffee shop, a whole load of Danes running around, like physiotherapist type Danes, and that was nice. And then it was back in the wagons and up to the patrol baseline. That's it. Working.
And then what's normal work then? What's day to day like? What are you actually doing in search?
So we arrived there with a specific task in. The engineer responsibility in that area, I guess, was to continue the building of a highway. I think they just called it Highway 1, which was a tarmac route through Afghanistan, the whole point being to improve supply of troops, equipment and everything for locals and for the military through Helmand Province. So it was the creation of a tarmac road all the way through Helmand Province, and part of it came over the canal and then up the patrol baseline, and it fucked off somewhere else. But there was an engineer troop in this particular area, and their responsibility was building a road from here to here, and our job as search specifically for this task was to search where this road was going to go for any IDs and make it safe so they could do their construction work, and then any other taskings that came in that affected that construction work.
Is it efficient, that way of working? Or as in, if you're clearing an area,
yeah,
and it doesn't take a couple of hours to lay a road, are they coming back in around you?
Well, in this particular area was reasonable.
I mean, bomb makers, layers, all that kind of stuff. The people that are actually putting IEDs into the ground.
Yeah, so in this case, it was fine because of where the checkpoints were. Yeah. So the checkpoints were spaced such that you could maintain, on this particular stretch of road, eyes on at all times. And it was literally that. You could see the insurgents coming in to stick IEDs under this road. Yeah. Like, you could see them on the camera. And it took like 3 days before we could chuck some fire down. But, like, to get approval to chuck some fire down. But you see them day in, day out, just trying to come in. What are these guys doing? I mean, it made it easy for us because you could just send an armoured wagon up and scare them off, and then they'd usually leave their explosives there, and then you can take that away and get rid of that. And
Yeah. And then what happens if you do find something?
You blow it up. So the way that...
Yeah, it sounds obvious, but it, you know, if you come across an IED,
yeah,
what is the kind of standard operating procedures? What you can see an ID in front of you.
Yeah. So if you can see one and you know 100% that it's an ID, you've got two choices. You can either exploit it or you can destroy it. So we as a search team wouldn't make that decision. It was just our job to either find or confirm that, yes, that is an ID. So say that an ID has been confirmed. We then call for the explosive ordnance disposal, which is like the second part of our team. And depending on which grouping you've got attached with you, they'll either come in and blow it up with a robot, or you'll get a high threat team in that will exploit it for any kind of intelligence information, so maybe fingerprints or other kind of biometrics, that kind of stuff. So you either blow it up or you exploit bits which you use. But the explosives themselves are useless, you just blow it up.
Are you looking for kind of secondary devices as well, like in the area?
Yeah.
Is that a threat?
Yeah, so there was a so overlooking this road was this big walled compound where the enemy kept shooting at our troops from. So we had a secondary task in as a search team of searching this all of this wall area, essentially, so it could blow it up and take down essentially that firing point. So it moves the firing point well away from the construction area, so it improves the safety of the engineer troops when they're going through to build that road. And over the course of doing this, we had a high threat team with us at this stage. We found a couple of devices. Again, some of it was seen where they were planting visually through this balloon mounted camera. But they had secondary devices on. So it was a pressure pad IED linked to a secondary command wire device, which has just had like a what they called in castles, you know, with the arrow slots. I don't know what they're called, but it had just this tiny little viewing hole, which was basically targeting this high threat bomb disposal operator.
So someone was behind there?
They would have been, yeah. They weren't by the time we found it and got round there, but thankfully we'd made it safe, and our TTPs, our tactics, techniques and procedures are pretty robust to deal with secondary devices as search and as EOD, so we're pretty good at covering those.
And then the threat to you from small arms or whatever when you're actually dealing with this stuff, is that high? Are you being protected? How does it work?
Yeah, so it's reasonably high when we're on route to a job, just like for anyone. But then when we're actually on a job, you've usually got an infantry cordon around you, and that might be a fixed static cordon, or it might be a roving patrol, which is just providing that intimate security to you while you're doing your job. So there was only a couple of times, thankfully, on our tour where we got shot at directly, and it was just a single shot, shoot and scoot type situation rather than any kind of sustained contact. And we got shot day one in our first checkpoint, which was... that's a bit of a wake-up call, but
is because you're a kind of specialist team, that search, and you're treated as an asset on the ground. To go and there's not 500 of you running around Helmand, is there? It's treated as an asset. Do you get moved around from place to place? So you was with the Danes initially. Are you moving elsewhere from there?
Yeah, so we did get moved around, and you've got. Your sort of primary asset is the high threat, and they always need a search team associated with it. So it seems to be on leave rotations. So a search team will go on leave at the same time, and a bomb disposal team will go on leave at the same time. And you need to maintain a certain level of high threat capability. So if the search team that was attached to the high threat capability went on leave, then another search team would need to be moved in, and that seems to be the cause of this sort of rotation, which is fine. It made for a really interesting tour. And we did move around. So we spent 8 or 9 weeks with the Danes, had a really good track record in terms of any explosive injuries. We had no detonations, found a whole load of bombs, made a whole load of stuff safe, and the construction carried on. So it was a really successful tour as far as we were concerned. Part of our job role is not just to physically go out on the ground and find IEDs. It's all about identifying where they're likely to be and steering people away from them as best as possible. So it's about threat identification as well. So that was really interesting, a really successful tour until the very last day where one of the Danish soldiers walked exactly where I told him not to walk and partially detonated an IED, ended up with a foot amputation, and is actually a very good friend of mine now. Really weird backstory to him. He's a New Yorker, now serves with the Danish army, but is a fluent Pashto speaker, and I have no idea how any of that came about, but he's a massive legend, and like, I've I've sort of kept in touch with him through things like Invictus Games, actually. So it was really interesting. And anyway, that was our tour with them. Went home we managed to get on Christmas leave. So we had an early bit of R&R because one of my soldiers had his first child. So we were sent home for Christmas so he could meet his baby, essentially. That was awesome. Came back from leave. And that was into, I think it's about 2.5-3 weeks working as the high readiness team from Bastion. So this was attached to a US explosive ordnance disposal team. And our job was just to bounce around wherever we were needed. So we ended up going to an ID contact for Household Cavalry. We did some air assault operations with the patrols platoon from the Parachute Regiment. And then we sat around quite a lot in Bastion as well. But it was just a really interesting time, like lots of different jobs, varied jobs we went to. Fascinating stuff.
What you said then about the full team going on leave together,
yeah,
and being with each other. Are you bonding together as a team? Because you've got a lot of lads, a lot of sappers, a lot of kind of private soldiers. You're an officer. Are you becoming friends with the team?
Oh yeah, definitely. And I know it's frowned upon in, you know, these leadership rule books and all this kind of stuff. You need to maintain a distance and what have you. But actually, I count it as probably one of the biggest privileges was to be in that position as an officer with six, you know, the highest rank was a corporal, so with six junior soldiers and me. You don't get that as an officer. Anyway, I was support troop commander in 22 Engineer Regiment. I had something like 42-44 soldiers on the books. You can't be close to everyone. You have to maintain that separation, you have to maintain that distance. But actually, I got to experience that proper operational camaraderie and brotherhood that you sort of, you know, you look at a section as an officer and you're jealous of. You want that kind of brotherhood and that bond, and yeah, I got to experience it, and we were close, and I see them now.
Let's move then. 13th of Feb 2011, you're in Nadi Ali South, you're clearing IEDs, and you stand on one, a hidden IED, and that's going to change everything. Can you just take us from that moment? I know I've leaped us a little bit there, but what was it? That day? Yeah.
So it was weird. That day was normal. So they have a rainy period in Afghanistan. It had been raining for about 3 weeks solid, it felt like. We were attached to the Royal Irish Regiment at this point in the checkpoint in the arse end of nowhere. But that day, it was a Sunday the 13th of February. It had stopped raining, so it was sort of clear blue skies, no gunfire, nothing, just the most peaceful day. We were tasked to go and clear two compounds with the purpose being that the owners, the residents of these compounds could move back in and start working their land again. So these compounds had been used as firing points by both Taliban, US Marine Corps and the Royal Irish at various points during a bit of a tussle for some land. So chances are they were going to be littered with IEDs. Most firing points are. So we went in as the high threat team, cleared the first compound, no problems whatsoever. Moved on to the second compound. Cleared our way into the building. So we cleared the outer compound first, and my search team had then moved into the inner compound and accommodation area to start clearing that for IEDs. Me, as the commander on the ground of that particular unit, crossed from one end of the compound to the other to gain eyes on with the infantry that were providing our cordon security. Turned around, and that's it. Stood on an IED that had been missed. And yeah, that was it. Blown up into the air, landed back down on my head, sort of sat up. No clue what had happened at this point. I looked down on my legs and they'd just been sort of ripped to shreds. Feet were still in boots. Boots were intact, but from sort of top of boot to mid-thigh, everything just seemed to be mangled. You see bones poking out and all this kind of stuff. And I was just screaming. You know, I'd love to be able to stand here and say, you know, I was conscious and calm and cool throughout, but you know, I was definitely conscious but not calm, not collected, not cool throughout. I screamed and tried pushing my way on my hands away from this site in front of me, and ended up with my back against this wall, and then my full screen, my team commander sort of came into my field of view. I'm not sure what he said. It'd be something like, "You're right, troopy," or something like that, and that sort of conversation with me, like that interaction with me, sort of clicked me back into the present and away from thinking about what was in front of me, and brought me back to the present. And suddenly it was, you know, my team were all team medic trained. It was tourniquets on, it was morphine in, it was helicopter was called, it was sat phone back to Bastion to make sure.
That's not you making those decisions, is it? That's other people.
So I,
you're just thinking.
I was definitely
it.
Saying this stuff.
Oh, you was? Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I told them they need to get the camera to take pictures of the incident. I told them they need to get the sat phone to phone our own ops room. I told them my zap number, all this kind of stuff. I think the reality of the situation is that they'd already done it. They need me to say. I like to maintain that I was aware of what needed to be done, and I think I was just saying things to sort of take my mind off everything else. Like, you know, that is not to give me credit. My soldiers did everything there. But yeah, then that was it. As far as everything else was concerned, they patched me up, stopped the bleeding, got me ready in absolute rapid time. And then it was a case of drinking water and smoking fags, waiting for a chopper. That was it. So I had my posh Marlboro Light officer fags in my med pack, ready to go in case of incident like this. And they mugged them off and gave me these cheap local cigarettes that were literally full of shit on the ground. It was fucking disgusting. But anyway, we were just smoking tabs on the
ground.
Yeah, and then you see these Apaches coming over the top, and you know that the Chinook's inbound, and then you hear those double rotors come in, and down it is. The anaesthetist comes off the back of the ramp, and I'm babbling on about how good my team have done, and he's like, yeah, whatever, and sort of jabs me up with all the anaesthetic, and then that was it. I was awake in Bastion a few hours later. So, 20 minutes to the chopper, and then 37 minutes I was on the operating table. Is it like
17 minutes after the chopper landed, you was in?
Yeah, on the operating on the table, not just in Bastion, on the operating table. I got the photos a couple of weeks ago. For the first time I've seen these photos. First time in 8 years I've seen these photos. And yeah, my legs were in bits. And yeah. So not bad. 37 minutes flash to bang on the operating table.
When you were still on the ground, are you in, because you've had morphine and stuff, what's your pain at the moment? If 10 was when it initially happened, that minute after, where were you at?
Well, it's weird. You don't really feel the pain in the start because you've got this massive adrenaline overdose. And then you're morphined up before that adrenaline's died down. But all it felt like, it felt like someone had parked a car on my legs. It didn't feel like burning or stabbing or anything. Mm. It just felt like someone had parked a car on there, and they were just being crushed like they'd never been crushed before. And yeah, I don't know why it would have felt like that, but that's just how it felt. So there was some pretty substantial levels of pain, but yeah, thankfully at no point was I exposed without some kind of, you know, drug.
Pain relief.
Yeah.
When you woke up in Bastion, what was you kind of greeted with?
I don't know why they didn't, but I wasn't put into a coma. So quite often they'll put you into a medically induced coma to get everything done that they need to. I don't know why I wasn't. So Sunday night, Sunday I was blown up. Sunday night I was awake in Bastion, and it's then like seeing friends, basically, like a hospital in the UK. It was seeing people from my units, seeing mates from Sandhurst who were at a theatre at the time, seeing one of my soldiers who happened to be back in Bastion. And speaking to the flight crew, speaking to the paramedics on the Chinook. Weird.
Was your feet still on?
No, they're in a burns pit.
Were they?
Yeah.
Is that what happens?
Yeah, just chuck them in the incinerator. They're useless to me.
Is that what happens?
yeah.
What about that then? To what was you... Let's talk about that. So your mates were around you, but at this point, where were you...
So
was this the? Sorry, I'm stuttering here because I think I've just thought of something that's related to you. Are both yours above the knee?
One is, yeah.
And is one through the knee?
Yeah.
And was that the only operation you had in Bastion? Major operation.
Yeah.
Because that's uncommon, isn't it?
I don't know.
Okay.
So as far as my injuries were concerned, they were very straightforward. Like it was. Legs were off.
Yeah.
Done.
Balls.
Balls. No. Took a smashing, yeah.
Yeah. What was it like then waking up with no legs? Or half a leg gone?
It's a weird one. So as a soldier in that situation, you're feeling fucking grateful, basically. So for me, I'd gone to Afghanistan fully aware of the risk of the job I was about to carry out. And I thought there was a fair chance, and we're talking one in six, statistically, chance of me coming home injured or in a body bag. So actually, the fact that I was coming home and I wasn't in a body bag was an absolute win. So I knew I was all right. Mentally, I was fine. My pelvis was fine. My spine was fine. My knacks had taken a hit. My legs had taken a hit. But everything else was fine. And I was going home. I was, you know, at least I was going home. And okay, it was 6 weeks early, 6 weeks before the end of the tour. And I had this huge feeling of guilt that I was leaving my team there. But from an individual level, I was going home and I was alive.
And what about the lads then? Because you said you were sling communication with the boys, they're still your friends. What was the impact of the team when you left? You didn't leave when you got medevaced out.
So I was in Bastion for about 36 hours. I actually flew back to the UK on Valentine's Day, late on Valentine's Day. So because of some operations that the parachute regiment were conducting, they'd taken some casualties at that time, so they delayed the medevac flight back from Bastion to Burma, because I was fine. It didn't matter. They could have kept me in Bastion for another week and I'd have been fine. I wasn't in a life-threatening situation. But it did mean that by the time my soldiers have been brought back off the ground, which is standard, so they'll get brought back off the ground, assigned a replacement for me, and then go through that RSOI package again to get ready to deploy back out onto the ground. That's pretty standard.
What's that, RSOI?
Reception, staging, and onward integration. So because you're a team, you have to train and get signed off as a team to deploy further on into theatre. So they'd have had their replacement search advisor come in, join the team, and then they'd get signed off as a team again. So they got back into Bastion and they literally got to the hospital as I was being loaded into the back of the ambulance to go onto the medevac flight. So I got to see them very briefly, checked they were all right, told them I was all right. You had that sort of emotional goodbye and that was it. I was fucked off back to the UK. But they had to carry on. So for them, and I never think they get enough credit for it, they had to watch, however crap I was, is kind of irrelevant. Like, they had to watch their friend, search advisor, their troop commander, who had just been blown up in front of them, get taken off in an ambulance, and they were expected to carry as normal on the ground for the final 6 weeks of their tour with someone they'd never met before, deploying off to an area they'd never been to before, and carry on as if everything was fine, which they did. They had they had an extremely punchy back end of their tour. The last 6 weeks, which they did after I got blown up, was punchy, and there was more death, thankfully not within our team, but within the units they were working with, and they dealt with it, and you know, all credit to them and all testament to them, because they just nailed it. It was quite funny, like, whether it's true or not, whether it was they were just blowing smoke up my ass, I don't know, but when we did our medals parade after they all got back, they said that they got their new boss in, and they basically just ignored everything that he told them to do and just did everything the way that we'd done it. Yeah. Whether that's good or not, I have no idea, because it clearly didn't work for me, but that's just what they did, and they came out the other side. I did think it was a nice compliment. Perhaps they were just blowing smoke, but yeah, it was a nice touch, and it did make me feel awesome. Whether it's true or not, it would have the intended effect, didn't it? So,
well, I think people are stubborn as well, and if something's working, especially if there's that that trust between people as well, that's hard to break, isn't it?
Yeah,
and the it's almost you were still there looking after them, and doing the stuff you'd been doing previous. So you're now in Birmingham. You go through a series of. Or a period of time in Birmingham, and how is it structured in Birmingham? Are you with civvies? Are you with military guys? Are you your own room, shared room? What's the kind of protocol with that?
So Birmingham is a bit of a mishmash of all of those. So Ward 412 in the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham is the military ward, staffed almost entirely by military personnel. But it's weird because you can have civvies in there if there's space, like any other hospital. If there's a bed space, there's a bed space. Mm. So it gets used. And you've got single man rooms and four man rooms, depending on basically infection risk. So if you're an individual who has open wounds or whatever, you'll tend to be in an individual room if you're a high risk of infection or a high risk of infecting others, just for hygiene reasons. So I was in a room, so post intensive care. So I spent about a week down on the intensive care ward when I first got back to the UK. And then I was in a four-man ward with private soldiers from the parachute regiment, and it was fucking brilliant. it was amazing. So they sort of, I think they took me from this nice, polite, genteel officer and turned me into an absolute scrope. And I think they took great pride in doing it as well. One of them, one of my mates tells me, like, you know, they used to see me in the corner as this officer sort of lying there reading these broadsheet newspapers in this fucking hospital ward. I was just there reading the telegram. I've never read a broadsheet newspaper in my life. But they say I was in the corner reading these broadsheets, not talking to anyone, and then one day something switched and I sort of fucked this newspaper off and then took my clothes off and I was just in the corner naked just having banter with these lads. But they were absolutely brilliant. They were great fun, and considering how shit the situation is. So in that room, there's me, a mate of mine who'd lost both his legs, another mate across the way who'd lost one of his legs, and another lad in the corner who was the reason why we waited for 36 hours to come back from Bastion, who died three times already but had all his limbs. He was our little tea bitch. So he was the one that, because he had his legs, he was the one that had to go out and get everyone's bruise, despite the fact that he had his hand stitched into his stomach.
What?
Yeah, his hand stitched into his stomach. But he was, we were like, oi, Buck Shee, go and get the bruise. And that's what he had to do.
Was it key to kind of that short-term recovery? Like the almost like the mental health side of it?
Oh, yeah.
Because mental health is perceived as you know, when you say mental health, it's, people think, oh, poor mental health. But on a day-to-day, we can have poor mental health. Yeah. And I'm assuming in this situation, I don't know, mate, actually, assuming, whatever. But your spirits still need to be high. You need to keep your spirits high and maintained. Yeah. Is having that shared room, was that key?
Is it? And it was exactly that. It's about the shared experience. And we'd all had a shocker. We were all in an absolute shit state, didn't really know what the future held. But the key thing was, and the key thing with anything, mental health, physical health, whatever, I think that the one thing which squaddies are really good at is that you're in it together. So if your mate is in the shit, you'll tend to jump in the shit with them to get everyone out of the shit. Like you won't just leave them in the shit and be like, oh no, you're in the shit. I'm fine up here, not in the shit. Mm. So I'll just leave you to it. Mm. You'll jump in and get them out of the shit. So that was sort of exemplified in this hospital ward for me. You know, there was four of us all in the shit, and we were all in it together, and we did as best we could to sort of cope with it. The situation was fucking miserable. The injuries were horrific in that ward, but we got through it. And there was a real, like, a key moment in there when you don't really think about it, but in hospital you see it on the news, and if you look through the casualty figures for Afghanistan, you'll see some that died in Afghanistan, and you'll see some that died in the UK, died of wounds in the UK. And you never really think too much about the detail of that. But we were in that same hospital where these people were brought back to. So those people, you know, amputations or otherwise, very similar conditions to us, brought back from Afghanistan, just like we were, brought into intensive care. And some go up onto the ward and some go down to the morgue, and that's the reality of the situation. Now, when you're when your unit's deployed and you've come back early, you're in hospital, you're in this hospital situation, your mates are going to be coming into that intensive care situation. And for me, it was probably one of the most horrific points in the whole thing, tour or otherwise, of the whole process, was having a mate of the lads in the room had to get taken downstairs rather than come up to the ward. And then to deal with that as a situation in hospital, when you'd been planning all these pranks that you can play on this guy, what are you going to do to him when he comes up to the ward? And then for a nurse to come in who you've never met before, just come and say, oh, he's died. And that, like, what the fuck? Like, how is that fair? How is it fair that we've come up from that ward? How is it fair that we've come up from intensive care and that guy hasn't? That was difficult, and that's when we kicked the nurse straight out and locked the door, and just that was a bit of a moment in the ward there where we were just sort of collectively understood that it was shit and there was very little to say, and pushed on, I guess. But yeah, so you get these real, real highs in hospital, real lows as well, but all balanced out to like an even state by the people around you. And that's basically the story of recovery all the way through.
Mm. Well, let's talk a bit more about recovery then. You went through Headley Court with their kind of platinum standard kind of recovery programs they were dealing with you, and part of your recovery was to run.
Yeah.
So when you got you recovered enough to get your prosthetics on and then blades after that, you started running. What was one of your kind of short term goals with regards to running?
So for me, like running was the escape. As an officer in a regiment, it was amazing to be able to go out and run on Salisbury Plain. It's where I got a lot of my thinking done. I got my free space, everything like that. So I really wanted to get back to running. Running on prosthetics is difficult. It is really difficult. I think my first run was 7 meters, and it was progressing to like 10 meters to 50 meters. It's like the progression was not, oh, I'm going to go and run a mile and then next week I'm going to run 2 miles. It was running meters at a time. It was painful. It was hard work. But I'd sort of set myself this goal that before I got my med discharge, because I knew it was coming, I would be fit enough to pass the running component of the BPFA or the PFT or whatever it's called now, the mile and a half run, which has a requirement of 10.5 minutes. That was my goal, that before I discharge, I'll be able to pass that test, and then technically I can say I was as fit when I left as when I joined, and actually it just perhaps put me a little bit in control of where I was going afterwards. So that was the aim, and it took ages to get there. It really did. It certainly felt like ages. I got my running blades about 10 months. In fact, it was 10 months to the day after I got blown up, and then it wasn't until February 2014 that I finally ran sub 10:30 for that mile and a half. And I, like, there's a pretty straightforward mile and a half route around Battersea Park, and I'd run that fucking mile and a half like 16 minutes, 13 minutes, 12 minutes, 11 minutes, 10:50, 10:45. I finally got it to 10:28, like 3 weeks before I left. I was like, fuck for that, so bored running this mile and a half. But yeah, so finally, yeah, maybe 3 or 4 weeks before I discharged, I finally got that sub 10:30 pass. Real chuffed.
It's again and again, it's when in recovery people are looking at short-term goals, continue and just trying to break those short-term goals. Yeah. Again and again, Ty Hammer talked about it in his podcast, where the small things like just getting downstairs, having a cup of tea, and then you can go outside, and then yeah, boom, 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 and it escalates from there. Why? It sounds obvious. Why did you have to leave?
It might sound obvious, but it's not that obvious, particularly when you consider an officer's career route, which tends to be desk based anyway. So I could have stayed in, and I could have flown a desk, and I could have flown a desk reasonably effectively. I could have done strategy, I could have done plans, I could have done policy, that kind of stuff. You know, all of the real fun stuff that you join the military for. But I don't think I could have coped with having to send people out the door all the time. I don't think I could have coped with having to do the shit parts of military life or the boring parts of military life and not doing any of the good stuff. You join the military to go on operational tours, as far as I'm concerned. You know, maybe other people have other reasons and that's for them. But for me, I joined to go away. Like, I didn't want to be flying a desk. I didn't want to be stuck in the UK doing all this kind of stuff. So for me, it was, even though I wasn't forced out because I could have fought my corner and stayed in if I wanted to, it was the best thing for me.
There was some compensation as well, so there is the compensation scheme.
Yeah.
I think it is relevant that we talk about it, because it's one less thing to worry about in many respects, and we don't need to talk figures, but it was enough to pay your mortgage off, and to allow you to do month to month what you want to do from here on in. You captained the first Invictus Games team, Team GB. Why was that so important?
So about the time I was passing that that mile and a half run, the BPFA, March the 6th. So this is then So I discharged on March the 1st. So March the 6th, we did the public launch of the very first Invictus Games. And we did that with a sort of two-pronged attack at the Olympic Park and at St. James's Palace. Now, I'd been involved not in the organisation, not in the delivery, not in the generation of sponsorship. I'd been involved as someone who can speak about the benefit of sport to recovery. I've been involved from the start. So September 2013, I was brought in to speak with Prince Harry and the other members of the organising team about what a competition like this could look like. And as a result, I've been brought back in to talk to sponsors, brought back in to talk to various different people. And on that launch day, I was brought in to talk to the media and the public about what Invictus Games was going to be, what recovery really is, why sport's important. And I think basically because I could talk about the value of sport beyond the competitiveness and beyond the physical fitness side, and I could sort of delve into the understanding of why it was important, they decided to put me as the overall team captain, which was a huge honour. But I was by no means the best sportsman, by no means the most experienced of sport or anything like that. But I could talk reasonably coherently about it, and my face is mega, so they stuck me on the front cover.
You're a good looking chap.
I know.
Yeah, you are a good looking.
It's a curse.
We went through Invictus, and it was a huge success. And I mentioned to you before that I'd never, as a kid, we'd look. You know, the Olympics come, the Paralympics would then start on Channel 4, whatever it was, and I probably wouldn't watch it. And Invictus for me was the first time when I thought, "Oh, this is not what it's about. It's not about the James Cracknells rowing as fast as they possibly could. This is about something deeper than that. It's not about the thing. It's not about the winning the medal. It is about that recovery for those that partook and those that weren't actually at the games, but driving it and competing at the lower levels. That's correct, yeah. Isn't it? There's people. Not everyone gets to go to Invictus. Not everyone competes, but there's a lot of people around it still having sport in aid, which aids recovery.
Yeah, so there's always loads of people in the background, and like with any sports competition, there's that pyramid effect where you have everyone underneath pushing that person at the top towards the games, whether they be competitors or teammates or coaching staff or anything. There's always that pyramid effect which pushes that person across. But you're right, you know, certainly for me anyway, Paralympic sport is so much it's so different to Olympic sport, and I imagine the mindset is probably different. You know, if you've come from, you know, being born with a disability and going into sport, or having an acquired disability and going into sport. So certainly for us military Paralympians, you know, we've come, and I think that this is the same mindset probably for Invictus as well, is that we've come from a situation where we didn't want to be in professional sport. We didn't want to be Olympians. We wanted to join the military. That's what we did. You know, that was our career goal. Whereas some people want to go off and be accountants, some people want to go and be teachers, some people want to go off and be Olympians. For us, we want to be soldiers or sailors or Marines or whatever. Like, this is what we want to do. This is our choice. And then that primary focus, that first choice gets stripped away, taken away for whatever reason. For us, it happens to be combat injury. You're then faced with this challenge of having to figure out what the fuck you're going to do with your life, who the fuck you are as a person, how you're going to identify yourself, how you're going to carry yourself in a community of people where the first question they ask someone who you don't know is, oh, so what do you do? Well, I'm an ex-soldier, I'm this. So for us, it was all about aiming towards something which would pick us back up and put us in a better place, and this is exactly what Invictus Games and Paralympic sport did for me. So it took me from being someone who was referred to publicly, privately, whatever, it didn't matter, I was referred to as Dave Henson, a former army captain who was injured in Afghanistan, and then blah 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 blah, whatever it might be. It might be has done his master's degree, has got married, has done all this, whatever it might be. It was always started with former army captain, wounded in Afghanistan. And that was sort of how I was defined. And the whole process of going through sport turned out to be this process of redefinition. So by the time I'd gone through Invictus Games, got quite good at sport, entered onto the GB side of things, aiming for Paralympic sport. Went to first World Championships and didn't do so well there. Went to the second Invictus Games and was doing all right there. Went to European Championships and then on to Paralympic Games. Came home with a bronze medal from Rio back in 2016, and that was all well and good, and that's enough of an accolade. But the real win there was by the time I came back and I did some media pieces, the fact that I was wounded in Afghanistan or was a former army captain was way down the pecking order in terms of things that was mentioned. So it was Dave Henson, Paralympian, or it was Dave Henson, medal-winning Paralympian. It was suddenly present with a future to it, not just something that happened in the past. And that was a real key moment in terms of that redefinition. And suddenly I had, as far as everyone else was concerned, a future, which allowed me to then sort of identify and understand that future was possible.
I mean, and you've taken that one step further. You're now researching your PhD in amputee biomechanics. Why did you choose that? What's the reason?
So my academic journey has sort of been going on. That's my leg. I've been going on the whole way from point of injury, really. So I guess before I went to Afghanistan, I was naive to prosthetics. You know, we've been taking a lot of casualties at this point. So you'd seen footage. I'd had friends who'd come back who were diffy a couple of legs and were then put onto these prosthetic systems. But naively, I thought, this is the 21st century. It's a bolt-on replacement for the leg you've just lost. You know, we've got... Your Terminator's been out for decades. Like, we're in the 21st century. We've got Bluetooth. We've got microprocessors. We've got AI. We've got all this stuff. So I just assumed that the prosthetics you put on would be robot legs, and they would be everything you needed them to be and more. So when I first started wearing prosthetics in Headley Court, and you realise just how deficient they are compared to biological legs, the legs which I'd left in Afghanistan, like, it just wasn't acceptable to me. So coming into that viewpoint as a mechanical engineer, like, you always know that if you want something done, you have to do it yourself. Like, no one's going to do anything for you. You might have to steer people or whatever, but if you really want a problem solving, unless you're prepared to solve it yourself, it's just not going to get solved. So I figured maybe I can just apply my unique set of experiences, you know, coming from the military and the project management and the planning kind of stuff that entails, and my background in mechanical engineering and now my experiences as an amputee, and just see if we can't go and make these legs a little bit better. And there's this underlying feeling as well that, as far as the government is concerned, they do not have a good track record of looking after troops in the long term. And I can't help but shake the feeling that, you know, we're currently well looked after. We currently have a budget for the provision of the best available prosthetics. But going into the future, is that budget always going to be there? Or are they going to turn around in 5 years' time and be like, well, we've got no budget left to provide these prosthetics for you, so you're just going to have to go on a peg leg and be happy with that, and that's what you've got. That's your lot. I just can't help but shake. I can't shake that feeling that we're going to get screwed over at some point and not be provided for. So at least if I can make top grade prosthetics, then I know that me and my mates are squared away in the long term. Because these things aren't great. But hopefully, we can start to make a difference in this field. And, you know, by looking at amputation not as something that is treated with just with prosthetics, but something that is treated with optimization of surgery, optimization of rehab, optimization of the clinical side of prosthetics, and optimization of the technical equipment that goes on the outside. Like, I genuinely think we can make you know, a huge functional difference to our amputee population, and that's what my PhD is all about. It's about changing things and making sure that, you know, not that I can run faster, but it's that I can carry my daughters down a set of steps or carry the shopping up from the car because my wife's pregnant. You know, that's the important things in life, and those are the things which I can't do. So it's about getting a real life functional change, not jumping over buildings or anything stupid. Like, Iron Man would be awesome, but there's a basic step to go through first.
Yeah, and are you actually creating prototypes now, or is it all just theoretical research?
Both. So so I create theoretical stuff for my PhD. I will create prototypes for my PhD, but I also create prototypes as part of my hobby. Like, I've got probably three prototype running these at home that me and my brother knock up. We're looking to really improve the way that that amputees run. And I know I've just banged on about it. It's not about running faster. So the project which me and my brother are currently working on is, can I actually design a prosthetic? And yes, we can. So now we're making a decent one. We do it. I do the theoretical stuff. And a lot of the theoretical stuff revolves around the surgical environment at the minute, implants and that kind of stuff. And the stuff I do at home is about improving the physical components, the prosthetics themselves.
Because we've got lads that are trialing this stuff and moving on, and I think that cohort, that military cohort, is key. I know we've got things like the Kazivac Club that you guys are really involved with, and almost testing on yourselves to make things better for everybody else. We talk about growth and post-traumatic growth. I think that's you're an amazing example of how you can grow and become better because of the trauma that you've gone through. What the future with regards to, firstly, you, and then prosthetics, we just overviewed it then, but what, realistically, with regards to yourself, what's the future hold for you and then with your work?
So I think we'd probably have to take it down two sort of parts to that answer. The medical situation for people that have received any kind of resuscitation, the future is difficult. So if you look at the cohort of wounded, pretty much all veterans now from Iraq, Afghanistan, they would have had to receive some form of resuscitation on the battlefield, whether that's a blood transfusion or whether that's full-on CPR, holes in the throat, that kind of resuscitation. It changes your body at a cellular level. So from the very, the most basic building blocks all the way up, they are changed as a result of these battlefield wounds that we're carrying. So the long-term effects of that are just unknown. We haven't got a clue what life is going to be like, what those cellular changes are going to lead into later on. Are we going to be at increased risk of heart disease? Are we going to be at increased risk of brain disease? Are we going to be at increased risk of any other number of diseases as a result of these cellular changes? Now, you look at the amputee population specifically, and if we carry on functioning the way things are right now, most of us are going to need a hip replacement by the time we're probably 45, 50, because our joints will have degenerated. So if you're an above-knee amputee, your hip's going to be replaced. If you're a below-knee amputee, your opposite knee is going to be replaced, and then your hip is going to be replaced afterwards. Your spine is going to need to be fused at some point, and you're going to have shoulder problems later on. Like, these are all things that carry on into the long term, and these aren't just guesses. The timeline as to when it's going to happen might be a bit of a stab in the dark, but this is going to happen. Like, there's no way around it. Like, unless you happen to have exceptional cartilage that regenerates itself and can somehow self-protect from arthritis, these things are going to happen. So you might consider the amputee coming back from Afghanistan. They go through that platinum solution of Headley Court, but what the actual situation is, they're not fixed just because they can walk and you've put prosthetics on them. There is a long-term consequence to these kind of injuries. But what we are faced with now is a number of individuals, a statistically significant number of individuals that have come back from Afghanistan carrying these kind of wounds. And that means that actually by offering ourselves up to medical research, to medical science, we can identify these kind of arthritic issues earlier. We can identify these issues relating to heart disease earlier. We can identify these issues relating to brain disease earlier, such that together we can actually collectively look after the rest of us, because you can spot these statistical trends. So if one person is presenting signs of heart disease, actually you can run that test across the whole remainder of the cohort and pick out those who are at risk of heart disease, and hopefully we won't have that many blokes die of heart attack because of this this combat exposure. So that's where that's sort of the medical cost, the long-term medical cost of coming out of Afghanistan and Iraq. We've got these conditions for the long term, and we need to stick together and identify the long-term risks so that we can actually live a little bit longer. That's nice. In terms of the prosthetic stuff, the future for that again is interesting. The developments worldwide are staggering. Unsurprisingly, relate to AI. Unsurprisingly, relate to putting power into these prosthetics so you can walk upstairs, walk around a little bit easier. But also, for me, the most exciting part is all in limb regeneration. And it might sound like something that comes straight out of science fiction, but for me, limb regeneration is something that is a distinct possibility. You can regrow muscle tissue. You can print organs in a lab. Like, you can do all of this stuff. It's about putting all of this technology together and sticking it into a leg that you can then stick onto a bloke. Now, what if we could contribute to the fact that in 25 years' time, you can just print a new leg in the lab and put it on in surgery, and actually amputation as a condition is kind of minor. It's like a minor inconvenience. You just, you know, you've lost your leg and then you stick a new one on and away you go. And this is kind of stuff that Imperial College, in particular in this country, are looking to work on in the future, is what about joint implants? So for me, I've got a through knee amputation, which means all the muscles of my thigh, so my quadriceps muscles, my kneecap, everything is still in place. I've even still got some of my calf muscle. There's just no calf bone. So what if I stuck an implant in there, which gave me a knee joint back again? Well, that one knee joint will allow me to ride a bike and go upstairs. That's a huge functional difference. I might not be able to run as quickly, but I can actually function better in real life. And it's not really that much of a leap to go from a knee implant to recreating a whole leg and then regrowing a whole leg. You know, this stuff is happening, but you know, we kind of need the guys to stick together to make sure we can push it forward into the future, really.
Dave, mate, thanks so much for this conversation, and we will leave it there.